Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast. My name is Matthew Sawtell, and I am an assistant director of practice groups at the Federalist Society. We are honored to host today's discussion on the regulatory changes proposed by the OFCCP on July 1st, 2025. And it is my pleasure to introduce our moderator, Linda Chavez, who served in the Reagan administration as the director of the Civil Rights Commission and White House director of public liaison, and now as the chairman of the Center for Equal Opportunity. To learn more about today's speakers, I invite you to view their full biographies at regproject.org. Thank you for being with us today. Linda, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Matt. And it's a pleasure to be here, and especially a pleasure to talk with our guest, who is Brett Swearingen. He's a senior counsel in Miller Johnson's employment and labor practice and a native of Southwest Michigan, but he graduated from law school at the University of Chicago. But more to the point of today's discussion, he was also at the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs during the first Trump administration. And he also sits on the Civil Rights Commission's advisory, state advisory committee for Michigan. So welcome, Brett.
It's a pleasure to be here, Linda. Thank you.
Well, I have a long history with Executive Order 11246, and we may get into it a little bit later in the program, but I thought it would be helpful for those who are listening to us who may not have much of a history on this executive order, understand how it came about. First promulgated in one form by JFK in 1961, and then changed and made actually more effective from the advocate's point of view by Lyndon Johnson. And that was when it became Executive Order 11246. Can you talk a bit about the original order, how it led the way to requiring all federal contractors to implement hiring goals and timetables for Blacks, Hispanics, and certain other underrepresented minorities?
Yeah, I'd be happy to, Linda. I like to zoom out a bit and view Executive Order 11246 is just part of this long story of our nation's history and its struggle against our original sin of slavery. And, you know, after 100 years post-emancipation, we still had widespread segregation against African Americans. And that was where we were when the Civil Rights Movement really became moving in the 50s and 60s. And a piece of that Civil Rights Movement that the government seized on was the hooks that the federal government has with federal contractors who, by nature of taking money from the federal government, the government has the ability to put certain strings on that money. And I think the first time the federal government used those strings for civil rights, actually, I believe that happened during World War II. So it goes back to FDR. But then, as you said, I think JFK was the first to use the phrase affirmative action in a 1961 executive order. I think we all know about the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which was obviously a monumental legislative achievement by President Johnson. And then a year after that, there was the decision made by the Johnson administration to kind of take the next step forward in terms of the federal contractor requirements. And that's one, what we now know as Executive 11246 was signed by President Johnson. Originally, originally the executive order only dealt with race, national origin, color. Not too long after that, sex was added. I think it was 1967 that the Johnson administration amended 11246 to add sex discrimination. I don't believe the agency was known as OFCCP at that time. That name came, I think, in the 70s. But OFCCP quickly became what I would argue was the most powerful civil rights enforcement agency in the federal government. And that's because, perhaps a surprise to some of our listeners, almost a quarter, maybe even, I think 20 to 25% of Americans work for companies that have federal contracts. So that's a huge piece of the workforce that OFCCP had jurisdiction over. And as their enforcement activities evolved, especially, I think this got really going in the late 70s, which honestly was in tandem with the frustration that the people in the civil rights movement, both on the outside and on the inside of the government, were having, seeing, frankly, less progress than they were hoping to, especially after all the work that happened in the 60s. There started to be these requirements to enact affirmative action plans by federal contractors that were very detailed and had real teeth. And in connection with those affirmative action plans, you were regularly audited by the federal government, by OFCCP. And those audits were quite extensive. And then if the agency found things that they thought were not right, that they viewed as either actual discrimination or just failing to do affirmative action the way that they thought you should be doing, there were real consequences. And being a federal contractor, you know, the biggest one is that you will lose your federal contract. And for some contractors, you can think of like the defense industry, that is a massive penalty. That would be the end of a business. So there is a ton of leverage, or there was a ton of leverage that this agency held. And that's why I would say it was the most potent civil rights enforcement agency in the federal government.
Let me just interrupt your history. And it's one of the advantages of being old, Brett, is that I was actually around during that period and remember very distinctly the Nixon administration's role. Interestingly, at the time, I was a registered Democrat. I actually worked on the House Judiciary Committee for a period. And during that time, in the 1970s, when Richard Nixon came to office, he had a labor secretary, Secretary Shultz, George Shultz, who later became quite famous as Secretary of State under President Reagan. And they enacted something called the Philadelphia Plan. Democrats didn't like that very much because it hit labor unions. And quite going beyond the idea of goals, these were actual quotas that were imposed. And it's very interesting to see the politics of affirmative action and how those have changed. I always tell people when they think, well, you know, you're a conservative, but used to be a Democrat. Well, I haven't changed my views on any of these issues in the interim period and was very much opposed when the Nixon administration came down with those quotas for labor unions. And fast forward to 2001, when I was nominated to be Secretary of Labor under George W. Bush, I got a call from George Shultz, of course, who was out of the government. He and I had locked horns a few times on this issue, which I'll talk about a little bit later. And he just wanted to assure me that he had no choice, that he absolutely had to do this because the unions were absolutely racist, and it was the only way you could get them to hire into their apprenticeship programs Blacks, Hispanics, and others. So just a little bit of minor history, and also to indicate that the politics of this issue has changed a great deal over time. I would like to talk now and move, if you will, to talking about the new executive order that was one of the first that was handed down by President Trump when he came into office in January. It's called Executive Order 1473, and it basically got rid of everything in 11246. Would you again, you know, just describe briefly what it's in? It's actually more than just rescinding 11246. It went quite beyond that in terms of its scope. You could give us a little thumbnail sketch of the new executive order.
Yeah, and you speak of the politics changing, and this is a very crystallized example. This was, I think, the second day of Trump's second term. He issued what's known as EO 14173. And in one fell swoop, and this wasn't even the main subject of the EO, he just revoked Executive Order 11246, which, of course, as an executive order, can't be revoked by future administrations. And he took a directly antagonistic view towards what, you know, LBJ had done 60 years ago, finding that OFCCP's enforcement regime under 11246 was leading to, in his words, dangerous, demeaning, and immoral race and sex-based preferences. And he threw out what he viewed as the agency's goals of promoting diversity and affirmative action and workforce balancing. Those are from the text of the executive order, in favor of three different things: individual initiative, excellence, and hard work. And given that this was the AE 11246 is the guts of OFCCP, it does two other things that we will discuss later, but by far the core of OFCCP has been combating race and sex discrimination, and unique among federal enforcement agencies, promoting affirmative action. And given that that all relied on the authority of EO 11246, President Trump in 14173 just gutted that authority. One other thing I want to mention, because it is very significant, not directly related, is that executive order also made clear that federal contractors could face False Claims Act liability by virtue of being a federal contractor if they were found to be discriminating. This was part of the anti-DEI focus of that order, but that is a big new thing in the federal contractor space.
Just to go in a little bit more into what the new executive order does in terms of not just basically eliminating 11246, but in terms of the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs, first of all, executive orders, you know, they are pieces of paper. They do have some authority, but particularly when you're dealing with a federal agency, there have to be some implementing regulations, and OFCCP has now put out for public comment a proposed regulation. It's one of the reasons we're talking about it on the Regulatory Transparency Project podcast. If you could go into that a little bit, there's very little time left to be able to reply, but there may be some listeners who might think of doing so. But if you could go into that a little bit, please.
Yeah, so executive order is a piece of paper. OFCCP has been doing this work for 60 years, and there's a large regulatory regime that has been built up via federal regulations that spell out the requirements for federal contractors. There's two other significant authorities that OFCCP enforces. One is the Vietnam-era Veterans Readjustment Assistance Act. That is non-discrimination and affirmative action for veterans. And then it also enforces Section 503 of the Rehabilitation Act, that is non-discrimination and affirmative action for individuals with disabilities. So those two authorities are both statutory. They have not been touched by President Trump's new executive order. EO 11246, on the other hand, is no more. So what the administration needed to do was get its regulations aligned with the new position taken by the Trump administration. So earlier in July, they issued three separate proposed regulations. One basically just to get rid of all the EO 11246 regs because they don't have any legal authority at this point. And then second, to adjust the VEVRA regs and the Section 503 regs to account for the fact that they now are independent and they can't rely on the EO 11246 regs, which again, now don't exist. There are two proposed changes. Is now a good time to talk about that?
Yes, absolutely. Let's talk about it, but also tell our listeners that the comment period, public comment period, unless it is extended, expires September 2nd. So we've got very little time left.
Yes, September 2nd is the deadline, and I don't expect an extension, though only the Trump administration knows for sure. It just seems like they're kind of in a hurry. That's my take on things. So for the most part, these proposed rules are not substantive. They're just trying to, again, align the regulations with the Trump administration's position. But there's two exceptions that are substantive proposed changes, and that both refers to the individual disabilities. One of the requirements that currently applies to federal contractors in terms of employing individuals with disabilities is that you are required to request your employees to self-identify their disability status for purposes of your compliance with the affirmative action and non-discrimination rules for individuals with disabilities. The new rule proposes to get rid of that self-identification requirement. And the reason they argue is they believe that asking employees to self-identify is a violation of the Americans for Disabilities Act. So that's one proposed change that's substantive. The other proposed change is to withdraw the 7% utilization goal for individuals with disabilities. That's currently the rule. If you are a federal contractor, the agency says you must aim to at least employ 7% of your workforce people with disabilities. That would be gone if this rule goes into effect. That also means that the affirmative action plan that a contractor creates for individuals with disabilities would not have any numerical or statistical analysis trying to say whether or not they're hitting that 7% target. So that's the two substantive changes that are part of the proposed rules. Everything else is just administrative.
Brad, I'd like to talk about the practical consequences of what 11246 and the OFCCP office have meant for private employers. I sat for 25 years on corporate boards, including two very large companies, each of which employed more than 100,000 workers. So definitely came under OFCCP. And you talked about it as the most important office in terms of civil rights enforcement. And I think that's largely because it was proactive. You know, the EEOC, you have to have somebody who basically brings a complaint to the EEOC. They have to exhaust their remedies, and then the EEOC may or may not take it up. It's very different with OFCCP. Employers are, if they're federal contractors, required to have these plans in place. And visits by OFCCP to gather data to ensure that the numbers that the company sends into Washington are in fact accurate, and the kinds of remedial actions that will be taken if those numbers don't satisfy OFCCP are considered quite onerous. I mean, nobody wants to hear, if you're in corporate America, from the OFCCP. So I'm interested if you have a sense. I'm no longer on those boards. I've retired, so I don't know how it's being viewed within corporate America, except sort of broadly and generally. Do you have a sense of that? Is this something that's being welcomed in certain circles or not?
From where I sit, the dominant sense I get from clients is confusion and maybe some fear. There probably could be relief there, but that's just not what is coming to me, where I sit and take phone calls. But I mean, you're completely right, Linda. And when I said that it was probably the most important enforcement agency, yes, it's because it was an active one. Like every year you had to redo your affirmative action plan.
Matt, you have talked about OFCCP as being one of the most important enforcement agencies, and we talked about why the EEOC has to wait for something to come to them by way of complaint. But talk about that burden on employers and what happens when they have to put together an affirmative action plan.
Yeah, Linda, OFCCP is very unique in this regard, unlike the other civil rights enforcement agencies. If you are a federal contractor, whether or not you've done anything wrong, you have a very significant compliance burden. As I've mentioned before, there are three different authorities that OFCCP enforces: race and sex under 11246, veterans under BEVRA, and individuals with disabilities under Section 503. Each of those three authorities requires federal contractors to create, on an annual basis, a affirmative action plan. And that is a formal document, many, many pages long in most cases, that in very detailed fashion documents the steps that contractor is taking in order to comply with its non-discrimination and affirmative action obligations, and also document the effects of those steps and what they're seeing in their numbers. There's a lot of record keeping and documentation requirements that comes along with the OFCCP regulations. And then again, if you see that it looks like there may be discrimination occurring, you need to document to the department's satisfaction that you're taking remedial action. So that's just standard operating procedure if you're a federal contractor to maintain on an annual basis three AAPs. In addition to that, there's the enforcement side. If you are a federal contractor, you are regularly scheduled. Again, I'm talking about the world prior to Trump's second administration. You're regularly scheduled for compliance reviews. And for a compliance review, that means OFCCP comes in and will take a very detailed look at each of your AAPs and see if they think you're doing everything correct. That goes from being very technical, are you kind of dotting your I's and crossing your T's, to a very thorough evaluation of your application and hiring data and using statistical tools to determine based on OFCCP's analysis if they think there is likely discrimination occurring. And if they do, then you move into a more aggressive enforcement posture, which requires more data, more documentation, a back and forth, some kinds of attempt at conciliation. And then if that doesn't work, this can spill into litigation. But all this can take months, it can take years. And this was just a very big compliance burden on a federal contractor, again, before President Trump revoked Executive Order 11246.
We did talk about the fact that executive orders can be issued and rescinded when administrations change. Do you anticipate that if there is a change in administrations to a more, you know, Nixon-like administration, if it's a Republican or a Democrat, that one of the first things they'll do is to put this back in place?
Great question. It is something I've thought a lot about. In particular, when we have another Democratic administration, what will they do with OFCCP? I definitely think they'll do something. I don't think they'll just let the current status quo lie. But I kind of do think that the politics of race and affirmative action have changed in fundamental ways. So again, I'm speculating here, and that we won't see just a return to, you know, the President Biden OFCCP. Again, partly that's because I think the politics are just different. I do think there's a growing sense among the Democratic side that kind of the state of their party during the pandemic was not great and it was not well received by the broader public. There's also just the administrative challenge that it's a lot easier to destroy an agency than to build one. And so President Trump has relatively quickly taken out, you know, upwards of 90% of that agency's enforcement power. And it's harder to build that back, though not impossible. And I just don't know if the Democratic Party will want to take that on right now, but they certainly could. So I'm sorry, that's kind of a non-answer, Linda. But
well, but there is, of course, another alternative, and that is that legislation could be passed that would implement some of these prohibitions. Certainly, while Republicans control both houses of Congress, that happened. But again, my own experience, my long history in this issue is that members of Congress are loath to do that. So do you think there's any possibility that some of these changes, I mean, just, you know, making it clear that Title VII prohibits the use of race in making determinations about hiring, firing, et cetera, regardless of what the purpose is, that may be something clarifying there.
I could see that. I could see legislation that just adds clarity, light on the finer points of Title VII, which is a pretty, the language of Title VII is very basic. You shall not discriminate on these bases. And so much of what my world, this practice of law looks at is what does that mean in this context, in this context, can you do this? And, you know, I could imagine that we'll get some of those gaps filled in, but it does seem, I share your skepticism that Congress really would want to step in to this kind of inherently controversial space.
I mentioned earlier that the Reagan administration did consider changing 11246, basically to make sure that it didn't just say that you couldn't use race to discriminate, but also it couldn't be used to give preference to any particular group. And that was really just a very small amendment into the language, but it was debated. Bill Brock was Secretary of Labor. He opposed the idea. We had a committee that was put together. I mentioned George Shultz. He actually at the time was Secretary of State, but he turned up to one of the meetings to put in his two cents. And Elizabeth Dole was Secretary of Transportation, and she was also very skeptical. Another person who was very skeptical, may very surprise our listeners, was one Clarence Thomas, who was the head of the EOC. He didn't want to mess with 11246 at the time. Well, be very interesting to see if this is challenged, whether or not his views. They certainly seem to have changed on the question of affirmative action. But let me play devil's advocate here for a minute. The civil rights community and many on the Democratic side of the aisle have basically said that what Trump is trying to do is to make employers, universities, all sorts of benefits in our society basically skewed towards helping whites, and that there's no longer any interest in helping minorities. And, you know, one could make an argument about whether or not today's Black and Latinos are in the same position as they were back in 1965. I think there's an argument that there was a lot more discrimination in those days. But what is your response to that?
I don't think it's a fair criticism, but I do respect where it's coming from. I take the Trump administration at its word, what they're trying to do. And, you know, again, I worked with some of these people when I was serving during the first term. And I think they are trying to, what they're motivated by is a true non-discrimination regime. And they do believe, and I share this belief, maybe not as strenuously, they do believe that OFCCP, however well-intentioned it was, Executive Order 11246, it did have the effect through the regime and the enforcement that it created of in fact causing discrimination in the form of preferences. Even though, to give the agency all its due, it had regulations that explicitly forbid quotas and preferences and set-asides. Nonetheless, I do think, because in many cases, if you had run your statistical analysis of your hiring and your application and it didn't look the way it was supposed to, the quickest route to get there was to just kind of subtly discriminate to make the numbers look better. And again, I don't want to accuse any one buddy of doing that. I do think it happened. So I think the Trump administration is trying to stop that. You know as well as me that we're coming out of a history where we had very intense ferment during the pandemic on the DEI front. And I do think there was a lot of push for kind of discrimination. And now we have, starting in 2023, we had this very significant Supreme Court case that said, no, Harvard University, any of higher ed, you can't give preferences even for the best reasons possible. It is considered a violation of our civil rights laws to give racial preferences. And now that's kind of flowing with the Trump administration's second term. That's flowing throughout the rest of the government. It is the case, if what I'm saying is correct, what the Trump administration is saying is correct, that there has been discrimination against often white people, often males, well, not necessarily, but discrimination in favor of minorities and women. If you undo that, because this is a zero-sum game in many instances, it will have the effect in cases of benefiting white people. So that part is correct. I don't think that's the intent. I think the breadth of Trump's political coalition shows that most of his voters don't see it that way either. But again, I see where that critique is coming from.
I just hosted for my Center for Equal Opportunity a talk by Jason Riley, who is a Wall Street Journal columnist, and he also happens to sit on my board. He's got a very important new book out called The Affirmative Action Myth. And what that book does is talk about what was happening to Blacks in particular during the pre-affirmative action date. And he makes a very strong case that the change, the rapidity with which Blacks were closing the gap in education, in employment, in income, was actually much quicker during the pre-affirmative action period. And we don't have time to go into all of his reasons, but you know, the same kind of, you know, the sky is falling comments about the end of affirmative action were made in California when California banned racial preferences in college admissions throughout the state system. So is it possible that you'll see the kind of things that happened during that California experience, which is, you know, fewer Blacks may have been admitted to University of California, Berkeley. They may have ended up going to Santa Barbara or Riverside or elsewhere, but they actually thrived there and graduated. Is that possible that you could see something similar in corporate America with the rescinding of this order?
I absolutely think it's possible. I don't think the analogy with higher ed is one-to-one, but yeah, I absolutely think that that kind of dynamic is possible. And Linda, you know, I just want to emphasize what you, I think you at least hinted at earlier, as one response to the critics of what the administration is doing. And that is just, it really is impressive, or it's important to see how much different American society is now than it was in 1965. 1965 was right in the middle of the Civil Rights Act. Sorry, right in the middle of the Civil Rights Movement, a movement that I identify with strongly. But back then, the country was very much white and black. That really was the racial dynamic of our country. And it was very much connected to, you know, slavery being outlawed 100 years ago. And still there was de jure segregation in lots of the country. Our country is so much more diverse now than it was in 1965. African Americans are not even the largest minority anymore. That's now Hispanic Americans. We're just so much more multi-ethnic and multicultural that in some sense, I think that OFCCP was an agency that was built for a different time. And it just doesn't really make as much sense 50 years after originally 11246 was passed. So I just wanted to realize that the difference of 60 years in our country.
I think that's a very good point, and one that I think is an excellent endpoint for our discussion. Brett, I want to thank you very much for giving us that history and also describing what you experience in the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs, and also encourage any listeners who are more interested to check out possibly submitting comments during this open comment period. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Linda.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speakers for sharing their time and expertise with us today. And to our audience, thank you for tuning in.
On behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.